For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website.
Hi, hello everyone. I'm very happy to be here. This is my second time giving a little talk here. I always enjoy this very much, especially the sitting. That was great. My legs are very numb now, but it's a good numb, I feel like. As Dan was saying, I wanted to talk about the Lotus Sutra today. As I understand, you guys have been involved in that in the last several weeks or months, in particular with respect to the question of the middle way. The middle way, as you may know, is one of the ways that Buddhism from earliest times designates itself. And this has already in early Buddhism, that is in Pali Buddhism, in what is now Theravada Buddhism, in those traditions, the middle way had several dimensions of significance. We know from the Buddha's life story, there's a kind of trope where the Buddha begins as a prince, lives a life of indulgence of desire, and then tries out the suppression or the ending of desire via direct willpower, as it were, rejects both of these extremes, which are then set up specifically in that way as a structure of two extremes, and is said to discover some third way, a middle way. And we'll talk about what that is specifically with respect to desire. We often hear already in early Buddhism another dimension of the middle way, which is a middle way between what is sometimes translated as annihilationism and eternalism, right? Eternalism being the doctrine that there is an eternal soul, unchanging entity that passes from life to life, let's say through reincarnation, and annihilationism being the idea of total discontinuity between life and death, let's say. And we have a middle way for that in the combinations of the ideas of non-self on the one hand and karma on the other, which are really two sides of the same idea, dependent co-arising, the sort of continuity that involves neither total annihilation nor an actual eternal entity that passes unchanged through time. So that's already two dimensions of it. A little bit later, when we get into the Mahayana, we have the school of Madhyamaka, which means the middle, Madhya. And there we get a great elaboration of the idea of the middle, right? In particular, the notion of emptiness, which is now a middle between being and non-being, or between presence and absence, you might want to say. Also characterized by Nagarjuna, the famous eight negations, so neither eternal nor annihilated, neither one nor different, neither coming nor going, neither born nor destroyed, things like that. And we see in all these tropes ways in which two opposites are transcended for some third thing, where we have the discovery of a third concept, which takes two seemingly contradictory ideas and transcends them or includes them in any way, see some way in which they may not be contradictory, or they might not be the only two options available for a particular problem. The Lotus Sutra does not mention the middle way. It doesn't mention the mean. The term does not come up. It seems to have very little on the surface to do with things like Madhyamaka philosophy. There's a brief passage in chapter 14 about emptiness, just a couple lines, but that's about it. Doesn't in any obvious way seem to be engaged in this discussion. And yet, the school of Buddhism, Tiantai, that Dan mentioned a moment ago, claims to have discovered something called the middle as a directly from its engagement with the Lotus Sutra. The middle, in this case, being a middle applied to what are known as conventional truth and ultimate truth. Tiantai makes this sort of unique move within Buddhism, which is it adds a third truth. And now where Madhyamaka had said, well, emptiness is kind of a middle way between real and unreal, or between being and non-being, and similarly annihilation and eternalism and so on. Nonetheless, in Madhyamaka, there was an idea that that is ultimate truth, and then there's this other kind of truth where things have particular identities, so there's specific entities which exist, but in ultimate reality, they have no self-nature, they have no independent existence, they are beyond any of those extremes in ultimate truth. But you see that that generates a different dualism between conventional truth and ultimate truth. Tendai says that it gets something from the Lotus Sutra that provides it a way of applying the idea of the middle way also to that relationship, that meta-relationship between conventional and ultimate, and with it to devise a number of other... the middle way applied almost as a universal principle to all sorts of problems, issues that had existed all the way through in Buddhism. How does it do this insofar as it does not say anything about the mean or about the middle? That's what I want to talk about today. A way of reading the Lotus Sutra and its peculiar sort of narrative style and the way it combines the two sides of various issues in these cleverly devised stories, narratives, anecdotes, tropes, which, read through this lens, this concern of Buddhism with the transcending of dualities, proves to be, I think, rather interesting. So let me back up a second. Let's go back to that first middle way, the middle way about desire. If we look at early Buddhism, what is the middle way of desire? There's actually two dimensions to it, as I see it. One of them is that, as I said, the Buddha rejects indulgence in desire, and he also rejects rejection of desire, right? What does he give you instead? We have the Four Noble Truths in early Buddhism. We have with that, as part of that, the Eightfold Path. And the Eightfold Path involves certain types of lifestyle adjustments and certain types of mind training, meditation techniques. Prominent among them, a way of engaging desire through mindfulness and insight. And that involves actually its own kind of a middle way. This is not traditional terminology here, but I think this is part of the way this trope works. The awareness of a desire, as opposed to the suppression of the desire or the indulging of a desire. That is, the awareness of a desire as a dependently arisen thing, as something that does not belong to self, to be an aware, that is, not to push it away, not to embrace it, but to allow it. Neither actively nor passively, another kind of a middle way idea involved in early Buddhist ideas of meditation, where one is attentive, receptive to all arisings and perishings, but at the same time does not follow them, is not at their mercy, allows them to come and go. Originally, this is part of a regimen which is meant to exhaust those desires. And in early Buddhism, this is, I think, meant rather literally, which is to say, as you know, in the Second Noble Truth, thirst or attachment is the cause of suffering. And this can be gotten rid of not by simply desiring to get rid of it, which simply repeats the process, but through this sort of middle way attitude toward it that is practiced in a certain kind of meditation. What's supposed to happen there is that by not engaging the desire in the usual way and yet allowing it to proceed, it wears itself out. The premises that it was based on, which were attachments to self and ignorant views about self and about pleasure and pain and possibilities of satisfaction and so on, if closely observed, if allowed to run their course, will disincentivize the usual process of desiring, and it will kind of, I always compare it to like unplugging a fan and kind of runs out and stops, reaches cessation. So desire is allowed to be there as a way to get beyond desire, but it's done so through the means of kind of a meta, second level approach to it, which is this middle way, this mindfulness technique, and that's part of an Eightfold Noble Path, which actually is also kind of a desire. In early Buddhist texts, they have no trouble describing that as also a desire, the desire to practice, the desire for nirvana. It's a wholesome desire. It's a kusala desire, a skillful desire, okay? And so even though desire and attachment and so on are the causes of suffering, it's recognized very early on that there's a contradiction that might be implicit there, Since after all we are trying to escape suffering, and that involves commitment to a certain kind of a practice. As you probably know, one way that this tension is handled traditionally in early Buddhism is through the parable of the raft. The parable of the raft gives us an idea of a temporarily embraced desire or program or commitment, which is taken on, clung to, attached to, like you would cling to a raft as you floated across a river and cling for dear life, but all the while for one reason and one reason only, which is to transcend, to renounce that raft, and that raft being used to get beyond that raft. So there, too, you have, as it were, a two-level middle way concerning desire, right? This desire, which is the raft, is to be embraced temporarily, so it's neither completely rejected nor completely accepted. It's temporarily accepted. That's kind of a middle. And by doing so, we look at our ordinary desires, and we allow them, within this meditational practice, which is the raft, to arise and perish until they run their course. They become among the tools, although a profoundly subordinated tool, in transcending themselves. They themselves do. Let us turn to the Lotus Sutra now on this question about desire. As you know, since you've been looking at it recently, the Lotus Sutra is in the second chapter, the third chapter, and the fourth chapter tells these stories about what it calls skillful means, upaya, these ways in which a misguided desire ends up functioning in a wholesome way. That is to say, where the Buddha is shown, or a bodhisattva is shown, to be skillful, not in either eliminating our desires to begin with or completely indulging them, but doing another kind of a middle way type of treatment, you might say, to those desires. Think about the burning house, where there are specific desires to play with a deer cart or a horse or an ox cart or a goat cart. Which are used, those desires are essential for the salvation of the children in the story. But the odd thing about them is, unlike in the early case, it's not that the desires lead to the end of the desire only, as they would with the raft as desire or with the meditational object as desire. It's now, as we're told by, as Shariputra says famously at the beginning of chapter 4, I believe, we attained the Buddha vehicle, we attained bodhisattvahood without desiring it. Bucho Zita in the Kumarajiva translation of the Chinese version. So without seeking it, we attained it. But interestingly, what he means there, given the context, is not that we attained it by getting rid of desire, as you might expect. Bucho, not seeking. We attained it by not seeking it. We actually attained it by seeking something else. There's this kind of deflectional structure there, right? We seek A, but thereby we attain B. And the relation between our desire, the means, and the ends there is now put into what I would call a new kind of a middle way relationship. You may know this from the, maybe the simpler example is the treasure sought by the mountain climbers. Now that story of the Lotus Sutra, right, where they are seeking X, but in seeking X, and because they're seeking X, and because they don't know what they're really seeking, or they're actually not seeking the thing beyond it, they're actually moving toward that thing beyond it. And now this is not, if you think about the structure of that story, we take steps toward the imaginary city, the phantom city in that chapter. Every step toward that city is a step toward the ultimate goal. It is efficiently a step toward, it is both of those two things at once. It is by seeking this and not knowing about this that we actually attain this and fail to attain the thing we sought. So a new kind of a middle way relationship, or a transcending of the dichotomy between desiring and not desiring, is configured here already in that first layer. That same chapter goes on to tell the story of the lost son. And the lost son has two more dimensions of this middle way, I would say. One of them has to do with a change in the ends and means relationship. This is very crucial for Tiantai, because ends and means, after all, are related. It's sort of the last dualism we have in Madhyamaka Buddhism. conventional truth, ultimate truth. It's still basically that raft structure where some set of practices, now with a much more complex picture because they can be ones that are directed consciously in different directions and yet ultimately brought back to this one. But still the same, if we stop there, we still have this dichotomy between the means and the end, right? So there are upayas, there are types of conventional truth, at least in the East Asian tradition usually, which all lead to the Buddha vehicle, right? All lead to the ekayana, to the one vehicle. Now, we have this question always, is the one vehicle the same as the means that get us to that vehicle, or is it something different? And this relation between same and different, it was already adumbrated in the Nagarjunian neither one nor different idea, this is now approached by the Lotus Sutra, I would say, in this next story. Notice two interesting things about that lost son story. There's many interesting things about that story, but two that are very relevant here. Two other types of new middle ways. One, we have a motif that will have a lot of further implications drawn out in the rest of the Lotus Sutra. A misrecognition of what is self and what is other, or a reconfiguration of how we recognize what is self and what is other. I'm referring to the story of the lost son, where, as you recall, the son is brought into the household, he is employed to do these menial tasks for a long time, but then there's a little section here which adds in a very important new dimension here, which is that then the son is employed as an accountant within the household. And that is to say, he counts his father's money. He's very aware of everything that belongs to the father, right? One thing after another. All his estates, all his expenditures, all his income, he has a very clear idea of it. So he knows it, he even knows it, you might say, better than the father, but he knows it in a certain modality. He knows it as belonging to someone else. He has a huge consciousness of a wealth which he is intimately involved with, but he knows it in the form of something that does not belong to me. Right? And of course, when it's revealed to him that he's actually the son, that means all the stuff that he formerly thought to belong to others were all along things that belonged to himself. This is a metaphor for Shravaka disciples who talk about bodhisattvas, talk about how great the Buddhas are, talk about all these miraculous powers, all this, you know, wisdom and benevolence and stuff, and they know all about it. It's sort of like a sort of theological account of what a Buddha would be like. But all the time they were talking about Buddhas, they thought they were talking about an object. Now we're being told, no, actually you were talking about yourself. You were talking about something you had already possessed. So that viewing of something now aspired to, desired in this maybe grander sense, like Buddhahood, this is the adjusted sense of what is desired on the path, no longer the ending of desire, the extinction of desire in the Shravaka way. This gets a little complicated and interesting, but I'll just leave that aside for a moment. But this thing that the whole path, all of those different paths talked about in chapter 2, all the three vehicles, they're all aiming to Buddhahood. You've been talking about that as a goal in the future, but now it turns out, no, that's something you have owned, all those qualities of a Buddha owned all along. What are those qualities of Buddha? How can you own that before you attain it? How does that mean? Well, this is the other interesting aspect about the lost son story. Very profoundly changes the model within Buddhism of upaya, or of the raft. In the raft is like Wittgenstein's ladder. You climb up it and you throw it away, right? Its point is to lead you beyond itself. The other shore is where you dump that stuff, right? You let go of it. But the lost son story works differently. The lost son story, there are a lot of upayas, methods, techniques. There are a lot of those involve a lot of implements, physical things, like a house, like the estate, like the servants, right? Like the outhouse, right? Like the estates that he has to count. All those are all symbolic of upaya, of skillful means, of what used to be the raft, right? Those are what draw the son in, allow him to reach the goal, techniques. But what does he reach when he reaches the other side? He reaches the inheritance of the entire estate, which means he inherits the upayas. He inherits the skillful means. The other shore is raft. is all these wrafts, okay, is the mastery of wrafts, is the ability to put forth the wrafts, if you like. So the ends-means dichotomy, which was sort of the last of those unresolved dichotomies, we now have, you could say, a middle way for, which is to say they are still means, there's still a means-ends distinction there, and yet, in another sense, the end just is the means. It doesn't collapse them completely. That would be one-sided, right? It doesn't say, well, look, no means at all, it's all end. Nor does it say, well, ends is one thing, means is another thing, right? That would be like the raft. On the contrary, we have a very cleverly designed story which allows the means and the ends to remain separate, remain distinct, and yet ultimately subsume each other, you might say. Now, that idea of looking towards something in the future and this middle way conception of its relation to your present self, your desiring self, your practicing self. This in Soto tradition, in Dogen, this would be something you would maybe easily relate to the question of practice and realization, right? In other words, are these a means to an end which ends the practice, or do they in some way coincide or overlap? In the Lotus Sutra, after we have that discussion, we have a long series of assurances of Buddhahood, sometimes called predictions of Buddhahood. Now, these are also interesting. They open up this question, also a great Dogen theme, the question of time. You see that the relation of self and other, the relation of present and future, the relation of means and ends, all kind of converge in the way this system is set up. One is, in all these different ways, even by denying being a bodhisattva, practicing the bodhisattva path. The bodhisattva path is a means to attain Buddhahood and to bring all other beings to Buddhahood, right? What's Buddhahood? Is it different from bodhisattvahood, or is it the same as bodhisattvahood? Here I am, someone who will be a Buddha. Now, this funny thing starts happening in the sutra. We have this idea of predictions or assurances of Buddhahood early on in Buddhism, and it's used a bit in early Mahayana. You find it here and there, but it suddenly explodes in the Lotus Sutra. It's everywhere. They suddenly go nuts with it, right? And it gets this expanding story, right, where it keeps getting applying to more and more people. I want to pause and think about this idea for a second, because the assurance of Buddhahood is not the statement that you have the Buddha nature in the sense that you could become a Buddha, that you have what it takes, as it were, to become a Buddha. It's an actual assurance that, in fact, it is a done deal, it is a fait accompli, if you like, that you will become a Buddha, this particular Buddha, who I now describe to you as an other. Just as in the Lost Son story, you counted someone else's money, I'm going to count someone else's money for you now, your future self. He literally says, the Buddha says this to Shariputra, that is precisely you. In the Chinese version, there's no tense, so in East Asia, this gets a very immediate feeling to it. That's you. Not that will be you, but that's you, that thing I'm describing in the future. That glorious body with this Buddha land and all that, all the lights and flowers and stuff, that's you here struggling to become a Buddha. So we have these two ends, but we have a funny kind of relation to the future that we actually never experience in ordinary life, which is absolute knowledge, I guess, with the exception of death or taxes or something, right? But something that's definitely going to happen, which gives me a new way of view. Actually, death is not a bad example. A way in which I experience my present as absolutely inseparable from that future. The only kind of analog to that, I think, is something we see, for example, in cinema, right? Where you see maybe a flashback. So here's this main character. You know he's going to become, you know, the serial killer or something. And then here he is being made fun of in kindergarten or something. Or here's Mozart. It's the example I use in the book, right? Or we have this biopic kind of idea. You're seeing him as a child, but at the same time superimposed, as you like, if you like. You're seeing all of that as this other identity that you know he will become. You have this kind of retrospective contextualization of those experiences, which allows you to sort of read them in two ways at once, kind of double exposure, right? This is a little kid being made fun of, and this is Charles Manson or whatever, right? So all those things have these double significance. They are what's happening now, but they are also these kind of threads of a definite outcome. Actually, another example of it might be memory. You have your own memory of your own self, right? That's me qua past. I am that qua future. But they are not in the kind of relation of uncertainty and possibility that we normally have when we foresee the future. Rather, it's a kind of, I call it a kind of prospective retrospection. I am a Buddha's past life memory. Right? That's what the Lotus Sutra says when it gets around, not quite, but almost to suggesting that every single person will become a Buddha. Why do I say not quite asserting that in so many words? Another middle way. A bit of a digression. Lotus Sutra could just come out and blurt out and say, everyone will become a Buddha. Bye. Period. End. Press send. No, it doesn't do that. That would be actually one extreme. That would be a kind of original enlightenment idea, perhaps, or a fixed self-nature idea of enlightenment, okay? What it says instead is all this cunning, performative kind of stuff. Chapter 2, the Buddha teaches only bodhisattvas. What does that mean? Why do I say that's a cunning, performative thing? Because that is a sentence spoken by the Buddha, and that means whoever hears and apprehends that sentence is being taught by the Buddha. And that means whoever hears that sentence is a bodhisattva. So I don't quite say that everyone is a bodhisattva, but I say that everyone who can raise the question about whether or not he is a bodhisattva is ipso facto a bodhisattva. Okay? So no one ever can, also like death, no one ever concludes, oh, it turns out there's no life after death. That never happens. Similarly, no one ever says, oh, am I a bodhisattva or not? Not. No, that doesn't happen. Okay? So a middle way, actually, and a very carefully designed one, or interestingly designed one, right, where it is universal, it is all pervasive, but in a way that avoids a kind of self-nature substantialization of that universality, if you see what I mean, right? If you go looking for it, it's there. You are wherever you go, there you are, type of bodhisattvahood, right? Wherever you look for bodhisattvahood, there's bodhisattvahood, and that brings us back to the previous point, which is, as I look forward toward a Buddha, or as I try to practice toward a Buddha, that itself is now the actualization of my Buddhahood. Very familiar to you from Soto practice, I'm sure. We have that in the predictions, the assurances of Buddhahood. We have it in the amazing stuff when we finally get to kind of the outer limit of the predictions, right? This is chapter 10 of the Lotus Sutra. The circle's been expanding and expanding, and then the Buddha just goes, he's talking to Medicine King Bodhisattva, and he says, anyone who hears this Lotus Sutra, and for Lotus Sutra, it just means the statement the Buddha teaches only bodhisattvas, right? So anyone who hears that anyone who hears about bodhisattvas becomes a bodhisattva, anyone who hears that and has one moment of joy, okay, one moment of thinking, oh, that's nice, how wonderful that would be if that were true. That's good enough. It doesn't say believe it. It says a moment of joy at the idea. Okay, again, one of these performative things. Okay, so simply having the idea of that possibility, and the actual term is a technical Buddhist term, sympathetic joy. Right, used to be a meditation term in the Metta Sutra. You guys do it, right? So you have the four immeasurable states, right, and the four brahmacharyas, right, and the four states are, you know, loving kindness and then compassion, and the third one is sympathetic joy, which means rejoicing in the good fortune or the happiness of others, right? So in this case, just like the son counting the father's estate and saying, "Wow, that's so cool that he has all this money. Good for him. Be nice to have all this money." That thought. That is enough. That means you will be a Buddha. That assures your Buddhahood, right? And that makes even more than that in that chapter. That makes you worthy of offerings more than a billion Buddhas or whatever, right? And that also proves, another middle way, proves that you have already worshipped a million Buddhas, actually makes it the case that you have, retroactively, worshipped a million Buddhas. I take it, and we can stitch together why I think that has to be the reading. But then it goes on to say, anyone who hears the Dharma preached by that person who took one moment of joy in the idea that whoever hears about bodhisattvas will become a bodhisattva, that person attains supreme enlightenment. And there the time collapses, I believe, even in the Sanskrit version, okay? So you have the floating of the idea of supreme enlightenment is such that it is self-actualizing. It recontextualizes all experience in such a way that that very thing makes it true. I can give you a lot of examples of things like this that are, you know, interesting kind of twisted double binds, right? I'll give you one to start with, though, right? I always like to say it's a little bit like the idea of humor. It's as if somebody said to you, imagine that there was a thing that when certain people said certain words, it made other people in the world suddenly start to shake and expel sound, right? And then, now they didn't touch them or anything, but they just started to quiver and shake and uncontrollably go, right? It's funny that there could be anything funny. Okay? The very idea of humor is ridiculous. And therefore, it's impossible to say, I wonder if there is such a thing as humor. Right? As soon as you understand what humor means and laugh about it, you have instantiated humor. I take it that the Lotus Sutra is saying something similar about Buddhahood. Okay, about bodhisattvahood, about enlightenment. If we proceed in the story, I think we have further pushing on this kind of a point. I see I have about 10 minutes to go. So I'll be quick. So you guys have been talking about chapter 16, the famous lifespan chapter. In the earlier on, right, we have this stupa come out of the earth. Right, we've been talking about the relation of the present to the future in these assurances of Buddhahood. Now we're going to start talking about the relation of the present to the past. There's a past Buddha inside this, a long dead, deceased, nirvanaed, extinguished Buddha who made a vow that whenever the Lotus Sutra is preached, his stupa, which is a grave for the partial corpse of a Buddha. You know, a relic, like a finger bone or a tooth, right? That's what a stupa is. It's a burial mound, originally, that's worshipped, right? So he says, and when I do that, my whole body, whole in the sense of not just a finger or a hair, but the whole body and the living body will be there, which will praise the Lotus Sutra and so on, right? And so it pops out of the earth. This kind of sort of a resurrection, right, of the dead there, but he's reconstituted. And that motif of reconstitution of parts into a whole then gets played out in this very dramatic, almost caricatured scene, because it turns out his vow is such that you want to see this dead Buddha now alive and whole, this already fragmented Buddha now of the past, the fragmentation of the past, now become whole, present, and alive. How do you do that? He says, I, Shakyamuni, Buddha of the present, have to gather together in one place all my partial embodiments. That's how I would translate that, Fen Shen. Okay, all my partial embodiments. And in doing so, suddenly all these trillions and zillions of other Buddhas and practitioners of Buddhahood and Bodhisattvas from all over the universe zoom in, right? And they have to all be in this huge numbers, the Lotus Sutra loves to do. And when all the present parts, when all my manifestations, and all Shakyamuni's manifestations, when all him recognizing all these other types of activities as partial embodiments of himself, just like it was a part that was in the stupa, part of the body, literally, right, in an original stupa. When they're brought together, the stupa opens, the past and present sit next to each other, come together in that moment. That is to say, I've recognized myself in the future by seeing all the otherness, all the other practices that are not me as also me, not in a one-sided, non-middle way where I subsume them all, but in neither same nor different way, which is what we saw about the three vehicles in the burning house story, right? The Burning House story said, well, the Shravaka vehicle, Prajnaka Buddha vehicle, Bodhisattva vehicle, are they the same vehicle or are they different vehicles? They're both, right? They are the same in that they are all parts of the one vehicle, or they are all expressions of the one vehicle, but they are different in that they, all the sentient beings have different desires, sentient beings have different needs, different beliefs, right? And so you can say all those three vehicles come together to be the one vehicle, but just like the father in the lost son story, we don't get rid of those upaya, those distinctions. That's what we get in the one vehicle, the ability to put forth the deer cart, the ox cart, right? So similarly, all those past, by all those other, all these other people who are practicing, all these other people who are doing these various things, and the Lotus Sutra is usually talking about other Buddhists. Through chapter 2, it's always some contact with a Buddha or a Buddha image or the Namu Buddha or something like that. Until we get to the Devadatta chapter, maybe. Until we get to the maybe chapter 25, and we spread out even further into all sort of opposed practices. But the principle is the same, right? The principle is simply the recognition of oneself, both in the otherness of the Buddha I will become, and the recognition of a Buddha of all his upayic activities as also expressions of his Buddhahood, are what reconnect him to the scattered, past, defunct Buddhas of the past. And this seems to be what we get in chapter 16. Chapter 16 says, yeah, I just became a Buddha 40 years ago, but what you don't know is I've also been a Buddha for incalculable many ages. I sometimes speak of myself as myself. I sometimes speak of myself as someone else. I sometimes show myself as myself. I sometimes show myself as someone else, right? And now the question is, does this mean they all get subsumed into this one eternal Shakyamuni Buddha? Or is this telling us what it means to be a Buddha? If it's the former, then all those predictions of Buddhahood we just had were lies, right? Those were upayas, right? Because we were told by all these individual beings that they were going to become Buddhas with their own Buddha lands. Does Shakyamuni mean to say, well, actually, they will all be, that's just a story I'm telling. In reality, it's all me. Yes, but it's all me in the way that his partial embodiments are also all him. And it's all him in the same way that the Bodhisattva path is nothing but the Shravaka path and the other paths. That the other shore is the means to reach the other shore. And it seems as if chapter 16 means to say Buddhahood and non-Buddhahood, the presence of the Buddha, the absence of the Buddhahood, are both types of being Buddha, right? The oneness or the manyness of the Buddha. If you look at the doctor story there, interestingly, a clear middle way between, I'd like to say, presence and absence, right? Because interestingly, that doctor says, I'm going to set up this antidote for my drunken children. They won't listen to me while I'm here. I'm like the air to them. I have no effect on them. They don't desire my presence because I'm present, right? And I'm omnipresent. Buddhahood's everywhere, just like laughter is everywhere. It's looked for, right? But if it were only everywhere, it wouldn't be anywhere, right? So in order to really have the effect of being present, it has to go away. That's what the doctor does, right? I'm more present. I have a greater effect. You are more conscious of me, more aware of me when I'm not here, when you desire me. Absence makes the heart grow fonder, right? And so it turns out the Buddha's absence is also a way, not only a way in which his effectivity is enhanced, but even an expression of his operation, right? A way in which he operates on you, part of the upayic situation there. The same can be said, I would say, that's the Buddha's presence, it's omnipresent. And the same can be said about Buddhahood, right? Buddhahood is recognized now in all the attempts to become a Buddha. And you got to search all the way back to chapter 2, right? So looking at a Buddha, scratching it with your fingernail in the sand, right? Slightly bowing your head, as well as more traditional Buddhist practices. Devadatta chapter, hating the Buddha, trying to kill the Buddha, all that stuff too, okay? Dragon girl, handing over that 3,000 fold world's value gem, that is the world, to the possession of the Buddha, makes you a Buddha. There we have that exact relation where in chapter 2 it said only a Buddha together with a Buddha can realize the true nature of all things, right? And there they are in that giving of the pearl, right? By recognizing everyone else as Buddha, or as seeking Buddha, or as seeing the Buddha at a distance, that is what it is to be a Buddha. And so, if that's the case, when the Buddha says, I've been a Buddha for all these million years, he really means, I've been a Bodhisattva for all these million of years. And being a Bodhisattva is being a Buddha, I now recognize, just as I now recognize that the separated embodiments are what it is to be myself, right? Those other Buddhas or Buddhas as other, right? The activity of the Father on the lost Son is the activity of Buddhahood. Final clarification on this. I mean, you could say more about chapter 16, right? Which says, when the world burns up, my Pure Land is still here, full of gods and men and gardens and trees, and I, eternal Buddha, who present myself in all these other forms and am present even in my absence, the more so, what am I doing? What is it to be that being? The last line of chapter 16, always constantly thinking of how to make sentient beings accomplish their Buddha bodies quickly. The striving for their Buddha bodies is the Buddha body, the one Buddha body which is manifest as those other Buddha bodies, right? So the one and the many. Coup de grace here, I think, you could say is this. Chapter 20. Chapter 20, you may know, never disparage Bodhisattva, I think is how Gene translates. Right? We're told this funny story. I don't know if you guys got to this story, but the story is there's this monk who goes around annoying everybody by saying, I dare not disrespect you. You're practicing the Bodhisattva way. You will become a Buddha. And he says this to everyone he meets. He doesn't meditate. And he doesn't read sutras. This is his whole practice. Recognizing other people as bodhisattvas. That's the whole practice. Everybody gets really annoyed and says, we don't need your cheap prediction of Buddhahood, okay? Get out of here. You know, you just say that to everyone. You don't even like, you know, I don't feel special at all, you know. And they beat him with sticks and they throw rocks at him. He runs away up onto a hill and then he shouts over to them, I dare not disrespect you. You will all become Buddhists. You are practicing the Bodhisattva path. Not the conditional if you practice the Bodhisattva path, as it's read in East Asia, but simply you are doing so. What you're doing will lead to it. All those guys go to hell for a long time. But after that, because of this encounter, they meet this Bodhisattva again. They're now ready. That prior karma acts as a resource for them. They all become Buddhas. Okay? So his prediction was kind of a self-fulfilling prediction in a weird way, but turned out to be true with a long detour in hell. But here's the kicker. After telling that story, Shakyamuni says, that guy, that was me. Okay? That was Shakyamuni himself. Now, you have to do a little math, I think, to get the implication of this, because chapter 16 says, I have been a Buddha for this many, this many, this many, let's call it 50 billion kalpas. Never disparage took place maybe 5 kalpas ago. Okay? So that means he was already a Buddha when he was Never Disparage. And that means the story of Never Disparage tells you what it's like to be a Buddha. It's like being someone who says to people, you will be a Buddha. That, I would say, is another middle way between seeking and attaining, between delusion and enlightenment, you might say, between attainment and non-attainment, maybe between practice and realization. And I guess I will end there. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So, we have a little bit of time. Comments, questions, responses?
In one of your books, centrism.
Yeah.
The punchline.
Ah, yes.
I wonder if you could relate that.
Sure. That's, you could say that's my way of trying to explain a slightly more technical Tiantai doctrine, but very much derived from the sorts of things we were just talking about, that particular way of reading the Lotus Sutra. So the idea there is, again, to get an intuitive model of something that is neither same nor different, both same and different, and furthermore, same because different. Okay? And so the everyday example there is of a kind of old-fashioned joke, a joke which has a setup and a punchline. So I guess I would use, in that book, I think I use the, my dog has no nose. Oh, really? How does he smell? Terrible. That joke. Okay? Now you notice that when I was, this one really worked well this time. You guys actually laughed. That was great. While I was saying my dog has no nose, how does he smell? That just sounded like a sad story about my pet, right? And nobody was laughing at that time, right? That was, for all you knew, serious, right? So let's just tag that with the quality seriousness, right? Everything in that sentence felt serious while it was going on. Then this funny word, this turnover, recontextualizing, as I like to say, word, terrible comes along. And it's funny because you laugh, and that's what we mean when we say something's funny. But strange thing is, you really could not say just the punchline is funny, right? I mean, if I just say terrible, nobody laughs, right? So the punchline really isn't funny. The whole joke is funny, if it's funny. And that means that retrospectively, that so-called serious punchline was also funny. It was funny in what we in humor is called a deadpan way, right? It was, without realizing it, while I was sitting there not laughing, I was undergoing a humor experience, right? I realized that only later, and that also makes me realize that, wow, I first thought that humor is only experienced when you're laughing, but it turns out there's this other form of humor, it's the opposite of it, which is in the form of seriousness. Humor as seriousness, right? And crucially, the humor will only be there if there's a contrast between them. If they're both funny, neither is funny. But if the serious one and the funny one are contrasted, then the funny one occurs, but the funny one means that the serious one is also funny, right? Okay? And we can even push that the other way and say the funny is also not funny in the original sense of funny, right? Which was what we believed had to exclude seriousness. So the idea here is that this is sort of a way of looking at, basically this sort of picture of delusion and enlightenment in the Lotus Sutra, or practice and enlightenment, right? When we speak of original enlightenment, we mean something like that, like the seriousness, right? Practice is the punchline, let's put it that way, right? And that means all other experiences seen in the light of that moment, just like the Buddha when he looks back on 50 trillion kalpas. He sees nothing but himself, the Buddha. Everyone seeking to be a Buddha, all of us, all this stuff we're doing, he goes, oh yeah, that was me, I remember. Right? It's an act of recognition. And in that act of recognition, it is both things are preserved. It has to be other to be remembered and recognized, but it's also taken up, reconfigured. It is also enlightenment in the form of delusion. Was not. Right. That's correct. Exactly. All that stuff is my own practice, it turns out, right? All the stuff that I thought was a waste of time, all the stuff that I thought was lost, all that stuff is... in fact, in Tiantai commentary, the other Lotus Sutra story, the jewel in the coat, right? The guy gets drunk at his friend's house, and he sews a jewel in the coat. So sometimes that's read as a sort of a Buddha nature reference, right? And it is, except Buddha nature. In the Tiantai reading, John Ron's commentary, he'll say, the jewel in the coat represents all your past karma. Okay? And so it's there. You don't recognize it as a jewel. That's all, right? But it's not some other thing besides your karma, besides past stuff.
Spending a long time trying to formulate this.
reminds me of like Anselm's death, in which nothing greater can be conceived. I can think of a dualism.
Yeah.
That I can transcend.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
when I get to the, when I had to think about the Tiantai transcending of dualisms from an ethical point of view.
Uh-huh.
I get to the question of what does it mean to have an immoral action?
Yeah.
Yeah,
let's talk about that.
Particularly, but I guess what ultimately the best way to say it is, can one perform or do something for someone else unupayically?
Oh, can one do something for someone else unupayically?
Unskillfully.
Oh, I see. Yeah, akusalically, right? Right, this is always the question, right? So, and this is why non-dualism has its enemies, right? Because... ethics requires dualism, right? It requires a yes and a no. And the early Buddhist way, I'm sorry, this will be a long-winded answer. I will get there. The early Buddhist way to deal with this is, I think, the one I mentioned before, the raft way, which is to say, we must have a dualism. We must have right and wrong. We must have the path, right thought, right action, so on and so forth. We must have good karma as opposed to bad karma, but the good karma happens to be the karma that gets us beyond all karma, right? And what that state is like, it remains completely apophatic in early Buddhism, right? Well, we don't know what that's like. It's certainly not immoral because there's no action associated with it. What does it do, though? It doesn't yet have sort of the Mahayana dimension of bodhisattva practice, right? But that same model really does still apply, I would say, for the majority of Buddhist ethics, right? Which is to say... there will be a the use of dualism will persist as long as there is suffering, because as long as there is suffering, there is a dualism that one is responding to and incorporating into. Not, it's not somebody else's delusion, after all. Again, on thoroughgoingly non-dualistic principles, it's my own delusion. This is why in Tiantai we have this idea of the Buddha's inherent evil, the Buddha's inherent ignorance. So the Buddha, it's not that the Buddha knows there are other creatures who think living is good and dying is bad, right? Even though he knows that's an illusion. And in one sense, it is an illusion. But in another sense, it's not an illusion, just like the setup and the punchline, right? And neither one of those takes precedence, right? Both of those coexist. And when any sentient being feels or prefers something, it's true that the value system of the person who believes himself to be suffering is the operative value system that bodhisattva would apply in that case. So I would say, no, there's really nothing that he can do non-upayically for another person. But there are things that, I mean, in other words, there can be actions that cause harm. But I think Tiantai view there was going to be, I have two more things to say about this. The first one, the direct answer to your question, would be, everything can cause harm, and everything can be turned over to a greater or lesser degree. Of course, the idea about Buddhahood is that everything is eventually, since we have infinite time at our disposal, to be something that can be used somehow to the good. And so the ethical challenge is to maximize the good in whatever situation has occurred. Now that presupposes that I may have done something at another time, but there's no final judgment, maybe is a way to put this, right? So you will never be in a position where you say, well, it turned out that was a bad action. Whatever bad action there may have been can turn out to be an upaya. And this is a bit like saying, any stupid remark can turn out to be the setup to a great joke, right? Any insult. If you're a skilled enough comedian, if you have the right timing and the right kind of wit, however much I may have insulted you, however much I may have hurt you, I can turn that around. That is the premise, right? Okay? So you might say that's a kind of optimism, but it's actually a sort of neutrality that means it can't really turn out either way because things just don't turn out once and for all anyway, right? That means there's always the present moment of action, which, again, it seems to me a lot like saying the wind reaches everywhere, right? How does it reach everywhere? By fanning, right? That means it's always available, but it's not there without your action, right? And this again is the point that is made. That this is why I say, you know, another middle way. They don't want to say everything is good. Straight pantheism. We talked about this in our interview, I think. That you know, it just is a fact that all actions are good, right? Just like we don't want to say it is a fact that all beings are Buddha. They say Buddhahood is to see all beings as Buddha, right? And they can be so seen, and to see them that way is to see them truly, among other ways of seeing them truly. But that's different from simply stating as an objective fact that they are that. Right? There's that little wedge of difference that means there's an enactment, a kind of performative enactment of bringing out that goodness in them that requires some deed on our part. Okay.
So we're a little bit over time, but while Luke is here, I want to use this time as so if anyone else looks at one more final question or response. Yes,
thank you for your talk, Professor Farnham. I had a question about your reference to humor before. You brought up the whole punchline thing where you said that, you know, just the idea of humor is humor.
Yeah.
Just like the idea of, I think you were talking about maybe Buddhahood is Buddhahood.
Mm.
But that seems a little bit contrary to what I feel like I'm often taught in Buddhist circles, that the idea of enlightenment is not really enlightenment.
Yeah.
And so either that seems like a contradiction or... maybe I just don't understand Buddhahood, and if I did, well, then, yeah, then it would be Buddhahood. But either way, it seems...
Well, I think the Lotus Sutra believes it is tweaking a pre-existing idea of bodhisattvahood, right? And so, and that's why it makes such a big deal out of itself, right? You know, what is going on? What's special about what the Lotus Sutra has to say about bodhisattvahood? It presupposes this whole discourse about bodhisattvahood. And that entire discourse, which most of the corpus of Mahayana Sutras and things like Shantideva that we're reading, right, definitely presuppose that. There's an aspiration to enlightenment, right? That's bodhicitta. And then you begin the bodhisattva path, and at some particular, and you have an idea of it in your head, and you aspire to it, but it's something other than your present state, right? But then one day, some moment happens, and you attain it. Now, the problem with that is the problem of the unconditional, which you know well from the other class, right? Which is to say, the idea of an unconditioned state beginning at a particular moment in time is incoherent. that was the position of early Buddhism, but it had its way out around that was to just say the unconditioned is beyond conception, right? That nothing could be said about it, which was fine, right? It described it in negative terms. It's in any case the ending of greed, anger, delusion, right? End of samsara. But it left that as maybe one of these parable of the arrow type questions not to be answered. But I would say Lotus Sutra, maybe in India, thought was working on this problem. I think so, but definitely by the time the Tiantai guys got their hands on it, and definitely by the time Dogen got his hands on it, they were thinking very much, and this is Dogen's big question, right? Original enlightenment, then why do I have to practice, right? Why is there suffering, right? And so, I don't know how you guys read it here, but I would read, you know, the time being, the discussions of time in Dogen is very pertinent to this question, right? He's looking at the 16-armed, 8-foot-tall body sometimes, right? And the bottom of the ocean and Mr. John and Mr. Lee at sometimes, and those are all the time being, right? Those are all this time being. So they're not something separate from you, albeit they're very far in the future, or very far in the past, or even modalities of possibility, and so on, right? I say that's the punchline to the bodhisattva path. So the bodhisattva path says it's in the future, it's something to be aspired to, means are means, ends are ends. This moment is this moment, a future moment is a future moment, right? You could say it's a self-nature of moments, right? And I think people like... in Tiantai and in Dogen, they think that's sort of sub-Buddhist way of looking at time. Right? So it can't just be that. But on the other hand, it can't just collapse into saying, okay, so you're Buddha, so you don't have to do anything. Right? All you got to do is think of the Buddha, you're Buddha. Yeah, but you got to think of a Buddha. And that actually is an action, right? Yes, I mean, it is what the Lotus Sutra literally says, right? If you bow your head slightly for a Buddha, in other words, become the least bit aware of a Buddha, right? Or hear in chapter 10, hear someone talk about it and think, yeah, cool. You're assured of future Buddhahood, but then this is pushed, I would say, in all these games with time in the rest of the sutra. So I think it's making a claim. It's making a claim that that is an important provisional way of looking at it. But the overcoming of it is not the rejection of that view. In other words, to say, oh, there's no point in struggling toward the future. No. The realization of Buddhahood is the distant presence of the future Buddhahood.